It's time. Thank you. It took a lot of effort to make that movie. It took like 10 minutes. Anyhow, it's been an exhausting week, so let's just relax. Welcome to this session. If you never met me before, my name is Marcus Murray, and I'm here to tell you a story. This story is actually about security, a topic that many of you find very interesting. Okay, the story begins. Once upon a time, there was a domain admin. No. He did not have red eyes. He's not waving either. The domain admin did what he always does at his job, his everyday job. He used his laptop, and he logged on. This is when it gets scary, okay? So his laptop communicated to somebody very important in this domain called the domain controller. And the domain controller authenticated him, and all of a sudden, his password hash was stored on his local computer. The admin was very happy, because now we could actually access resources on this network. But something happened. The evil attacker came along. And the evil attacker used some evil attacker techniques, and he stole the password hash from the poor old domain admin. He was so happy. The attacker, his heart was pounding. His entire being excelled. He knew that now, this very day, he was going to become the domain admin himself. A dream he had since he was a kid. So the evil hacker took the hash, put it in his own evil red laptop. Not red like Novell, because that hardly exists anymore, but anyhow. So, he was trying to mount the golden share of the domain controller called C-Dollar, which is like the treasure in the end of the rainbow. Unless you have different partitions, of course. Why are you laughing? You're the wolf. This is Little Red Riding Hood. Anyhow, back to the story. So, happy as he is, the evil attacker, he tries to mount the C-Dollar share on the domain controller. But you know what? He fails! And do you know why? Because this is a story about the future. The domain admin was attending TechEd 2014 North America. And he went to see a session by Marcus Murray and Hassan the Wolf al-Shakarti. And they showed him what authentication mechanism assurance is. So even though he was using the same account and the password hash was still stored, nothing bad could happen because of the fact that whenever you use authentication mechanism assurance, it means that your certificate template that you use to log on will add you to a dynamic group on the domain controller. That group was put in the domain admins group. So when you steal the hash, you're not a member of that group, but when you have the smart card and log on, then you're a member. So the happy ending is, you are that guy. You're going to implement this in the future because you attended this session. And a sign is going to tell you how. And again, if you never met us before, my name is Marcus Murray. I'm the security manager of a company called TrueSec. And this is
Hassan Shakarti. I work at TrueSec as well. We've been working together for nearly 15 years or a little bit more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the fun part about this session. Now the real important, but yet so boring for some people. Not for you, because you're here, but for everybody else.
Great.
Begins.
Thank you, Marcus. So let's see this, the code behind the thing Marcus just showed you on paper.
You forgot what it was?
Yeah.
Authentication mechanism assurance.
Good. Thanks. So I'm just remote desktoping to one of my machines over here, and I'm apparently performing a smart card logon to that guy. So let's just see how that ends. Proceeding with my session. And we will soon just check what about the security groups and the security token this user is getting at the end of this logon session.
You can have the share back now if you want to. That was obviously not funny.
So I just logged into this system using remote desktop. I'm just doing /groups. This is where all the good information relies. The first observation we make is actually this group down here. It's called this organization certificate. So this is telling us that the logon session has been performed using a smart card. This is something we received or we got in Windows Server 2008 R2 and Windows 7 on the client side. This is something Microsoft is using internally if you run direct access and you would like to have strong authentication or multi-factor authentication using smart cards. That's how direct access sees that you are logged in to your client computer using a smart card. So the thing Marcus told you about, the authentication mechanism assurance, that feature was introduced at the same time. Now this is the result of a configured authentication mechanism assurance example. So once we are logged in with that user using a specific certificate on the smart card, we're actually receiving a group membership. So we're looking at our security token in this session. And it says I'm a member of a domain server admins group. That's a domain group. You can see if you observe the SID, this is not a built-in, any of the built-in groups, the RID portion is reading a higher value than the built-in groups. So let's just check that group. I go to my domain controller, I go to Active Directory, users and computers, or if you would like you to the admin center. Let's see, and we do have the domain servers admin group. There we go. This is the group I'm apparently member of, as stated by my security token. Now, if we check members in here, it's totally empty.
It's magic.
And this group can actually never have any static members. If I try to add a static member to it, apply, it says, no. This group is handled by domain controllers themselves. This is a so-called OID map groups. That's It's related to information found on your certificate. So at the time of logon, the domain controller will realize that, hey, you should have that group in your security token just because you have that attribute in your certificate. And that's where the mapping is helping us. So you can never figure out who's a member in that group or who got that level of access. You need to look at who got that type of certificate instead. I'll just show you the same effect, just signing out, in case you're still doubting about that. Just performing a username It's the same user, and just performing a username password logon. And who am I? As you can see here now that the server admin group is no more. You see all these are the built-in groups. This is a domain admin. And we don't have that this organization certificate in the list either. So none of these two groups, the built-in this organization certificate we have there is not there anymore, and our customized group is not there anymore.
So when you think about it, this is one of the probably strongest way to solve the passing the hash problem. You can steal the hash, but you will only become that user, not a member of the admin groups. You could use this strategy for file access and stuff as well, but that's what it was intended for. That's why they made authentication mechanism assurance. It's kind of interesting. We've been using this since it came out a couple of years ago for securing admin roles and admin accounts. When you look at the Microsoft guides about mitigating passing the hash, it's not there. Mm-hmm. So I think this is really strong, but it's not really communicated by Microsoft. I hope it will be, because it was made for another to fix another problem.
Yeah.
But it can be easily used to fix this problem.
This is widely used within applications. So you add properties or extensions to your certificate and use them in your applications for authorization, authentication purposes. As you see, there is an extension here called Server Admins. It's actually translated by the system, it knows about the internals here. So if we look at the certification policies or certificate policies, you see that server admin policy is part of this certificate. So this is what the domain controller is looking for. So it's looking for that object and it's mapped to a security group. I will get that security group in my security token once I've done the logon. So that's the magic behind it. Now, this is a very strong and very difficult authorization method to change as well. So if you want to give somebody access or making them members of this group, you need to issue or reissue a certificate to those guys. If somebody wants to have that access level, they must have that smart card or the certificate that's been in use. So let's see. The other part in here, actually, the way we demonstrated this, I'm using a smart card logon, but I don't have any physical smart card on my system. So these are actually two components we've been showing you guys. So if we just stop for a moment here and just scroll back and see. I'm actually using, the system tells me, hey, there are two readers. I do actually have a physical smart card reader as well. But it's not that one that's being used. The one being used is the virtual smart card zero reader. And in that card, there is a present card identity device, Microsoft generic profile. It's a virtual smart card that resides on my device, on my system. So I'm using that as my logon smart card on the system. As you can see, the behavior is very similar. I got it listed. Once there is an authentication request for username and password, it's got listed just like any other smart card in the system. The only big difference here is that I cannot take this virtual smart card from this device and put it on something else. I need to create another virtual smart card on that device and push another certificate on that one.
Yeah, the smart card is protected by the TPM chip. So we would say it's in many ways equally strong
to real physical smart card. There's an obvious difference. You can only use it in the very same computer. But again, it mitigates the problem of somebody stealing your hash and then move to another place and reuse it. And if you worry about the fact that, well, it still doesn't fix the problem when you're on the same computer, well, that counts for the smart card as well. When it's plugged in, then you can use the credentials of that one. And that doesn't even have to do anything with hashes. When you are logged on as somebody who has all these rights and group memberships in its current context, then you can just impersonate the processes running under his token. Then you can connect to resources anyway. So the problem with passing the hash and stuff is the fact that you can take these credentials and you can use them someplace else. And the thing that makes it extra bad that everybody's talking about is the fact that that is something that you can do from any computers. You can jump around and keep that domain admin credential with you. Okay? Because it's interesting, everybody's talking about this problem. It's been a high priority for Microsoft, you know, the last year, but nobody talked about this solution. And the virtual smart card adds to the flavor because it makes it a way smaller investment, if you will. And not everybody wants to go for smart cards, not even for admins, but with the virtual smart cards, it's fine. A question, sir. You know what? This is a big room. I would be very happy if you could step up to the mic and ask the question, and that's not only because we can't hear you and the audience can't hear you, it's also because it's being recorded. So that would be great if you could just go to the mics. Thank you.
Yes, hello. Question, the template that you've just shown us for the certificate, the server admin, basically, is that built in or is it a custom template that you have created?
That is a very good question, actually. And I think that is one thing that we want to show. What makes this smart card map to that group? Because it's something we set in the template. So I think Hassan can show you that.
Yeah. It's actually a custom-built template that's a version 2 template, as you can see the schema version over here. So just customize the built-in smart card logon template. It's a copy of that, basically. And the major adjustment I did on this one is on the extensions tab. That's where we add extensions or attributes to our certificates. And if you look further on that extension tab and look at the issuance policies, as you can see here, I have a policy called server admins. If I go edit that extension, this is the server admin issuance policy, aka certificate policy. So edit that is all about a text label, a name, a display name if you will to. And there is an object identifier. These things are very common within Active Directory, as Active Directory objects are. So there is an object ID, and there is a label for that one. And now the system, because this has got replicated and synchronized to all of our Active Directory members, the system knows about this name. So I could rename it the way I would like to. The system will just give me the new name. So the whole thing is the object ID, actually, we have in the background. Now, this is the story about the template itself. So the connection is likewise pretty simple as well. For that, I'd like to use the Sites and Services tool. Actually, Microsoft has never provided a real tool to manage or configure this. There is a PowerShell or a couple of PowerShell scripts on TechNet. So if you search for authentication mechanism assurance, you probably end up in that page and see those PowerShell scripts. So you can enumerate using these scripts what kind of authentication mechanism assurance policies are set and so on. But the whole thing is actually a connection between, this is the OID object. As you can see, the display name over here, it reads server admin. Okay, it's the same object I just looked at in the certificate template. And if I go check the properties on it and go to the attribute editor and just scroll down one page, I do have the attribute of MSDS-OID to group link, which is actually pointing out the fully qualified distinguished name of that security group. So that's the mapping between these two objects in Active Directory, and that's why the group has got protected by domain controllers the way I just show you. I couldn't add any static members to it.
And again, this may look like a little bit of a deep dive to go in and do this manually. There are PowerShell scripts, like Hassan said, to do that. So all you need to have is a strategy. You come up with a strategy, what people are in which groups. You issue templates and you issue the virtual or the real smart cards. And then that's it. Mm. The next job is just to take everybody else out from the domain admins group or whatever group it is. I mean, you can do this for server admins and everybody else as well. But it's not much work compared to what you gain for it.
So if we already have a working enterprise PKI, if we're already dealing with smart cards, this is just an adjustment. You create a new template and start issuing those certificates. If you're not having that, I think both me and Marcus will really recommend you start looking into this, at least for your admins or the most important accounts with the highest privileges in your environment. That would be maybe a handful of them or so.
Yeah. No, we see this every day. We see the intrusions and the breaches when people get hacked. And this is the number one way to navigate an environment after you do the initial breach. Mm. You use password dependencies or credential dependencies. And in our mind, this is the best solution if you have this technology, if you have modern enough platforms.
Yeah.
If you're running XP, then you have different problems. Okay? Can somebody commit? Can somebody tell me that I promise until next TechEd, I will have implemented this? I promise to cross my heart. The first guy who stands in front of me and says this to my face. I mean, to be honest, I mean, this is the most rewarding thing. I had 10 people promise to change their entire admin infrastructure for a bar of chocolate. And again, it makes it feel worth it to communicate this as well. We affected at least 6 people. That's good. Mm-hmm. 6 out of 1,500, that's a good number.
So just to not leave you with any unknowns here, this will help very, very efficiently against passing the hash problem. Now, taking the anti-hash and passing it along and achieving an authenticated session. This still doesn't address. It's not addressing passing the tickets, okay? So there is a big difference between these two things. If you got a Kerberos ticket, that Kerberos ticket will still include that security group. So if you can extract this ticket, export it, play with it, or inject yourself into this process I was running, then you are that person with that amount of access. So we still need to remember that. These are two different things. Now, what can we do about this fact? Microsoft actually provided us with another solution. I was introducing Windows Server 2012 R2. That's a solution to deal with reducing the amount of time a Kerberos ticket is valid. So beginning with Server 2012 R2, we are able to reduce the number of minutes a ticket is valid for a certain security group or users. And to do that, we need to navigate our way into the Active Directory Administrative Center and start looking at the authentication container, and we find the authentication policies container. This is where we can define restrictions or constraints or boundaries to our, let's see, I do a 45 minutes. That's actually the minimum. And just tell domain admins. Domain. Oh, sorry, yeah. I'll take the admin account.
That deserves a gift. The one who said object types. So what would you choose between a TrueSec t-shirt and a speaker shirt? Of course. It's here waiting for you. It's XXL, so I hope that you, have somebody who appreciates it, or you like them wide, or you can use it as a tent or whatever you want to, because it's the only one I have left. And don't leave because of this. I still have chocolate, okay?
Yeah. So I just specified the account in this specific case and go ahead to the there are users, services, and computers. I just could specify the new maximum time for a ticket granting ticket, which can be set to a minimum of 45 minutes. So this will reduce the window down to 45 minutes. If you got that ticket, it's only valid for the next 45 minutes at best. And then we can have probably some other countermeasures. We deal with restarting the machines or whatever if we're logging in some uncertain situations, or would like to make sure that the tickets, the credentials are not left behind. So these are the possible measures we do or we can take.
Yes, great.
What else?
What else? What do you want to talk about?
We used to try to remind people of the old user access rights.
Access rights?
Yeah.
That's not very sexy, I sign.
No, I know. They are old. It's from Windows NT.
I was trying to be funny. You should like smile or something.
I don't know. Yeah, does he smile?
Yeah, smile. He never smiles. It's funny.
Yeah. The user access rights, we find them on the local policies. I'm just looking at the group policy object over here. It's a security setting, local policies, user access assignments, or user access rights. We can define different conditions where we tell, hey, for that specific group of users or that account, I would like to enforce some restrictions. It's like, okay, access this computer from network. I can start playing with, okay, who can access what computer, what type of accounts, what type of users. There are some default values, as you can see. Access this computer from network is not restricted that very much. All local admins, which includes domain admins, may access any computer in our domain. So this makes it basically wide open. If you got that domain admin credentials, you can access whatever computer you would like to, which is pretty, I mean, obviously it's comes very handy, but in this situation, if we care about the credentials being passed through forth and back between different machines, this is what we want to do. We would like to restrict domain admins only on domain controllers, or maybe there is some their own laptops they can use to manage the domain from them and so on. So we can define these type of group policy object with this type of restriction. And that's actually, I guess, Mark Kucinovich has been speaking about that, at least since the beginning of this year. Start thinking into authentication silos. Think this user account mapping to this machine, mapping to this scenario, this type of access. It's a very efficient way of putting that together.
Yeah. And again, if you want to create the simplest solution ever, I mean, just put your different servers in roles, depending on the size of your organization, of course. If you're only one IT guy, then it's a different story. But, I mean, there is a role for domain controllers. There's one group of people that should be able to admin these, and only the domain admins. You cannot use domain admin rights to log on into regular servers. So you can have one or more server groups. That's fine. Servers or front-end servers or web servers or SQL servers. But these are server groups, server admins. One thing that people tend to forget is the support technicians, the guys that can log on to any workstation. Support. A typical attack that we have seen many times over the year is that they obtain credentials of a support technician. Then they use that to log on to each and every workstation until one domain admin logs on from his own machine. Then they steal the domain admin credentials from there. So a support guy should not be able to reset a domain admin. Makes sense. So those small things, these are the reasons people can break in and compromise environments. They can move from one silo to another. So you have to like make the design, make the silos, and make these rock-hard isolations between them. That is the way to go if you really want to survive an attack.
We actually have a couple of customers that has made the simple decision. If a client computer got any kind of errors, we are not troubleshooting it. We're just pressing the F12. We're just redeploying it or refreshing that machine because we know that we are synchronizing all the user documents. We know that we do have proper backup of all that kind of information. We've told our users, never save any files unless they go in this folder or that folder, because these will be synchronized, these will be backed up. So at any time, if anything happens with the machine, we don't do any troubleshooting. We just refresh that machine, redeploy it.
Yeah.
That's a very simple yet effective solution, because you never need to put any credentials in there. Yeah. Another way of doing it more securely is only relying on remote management, that you never perform any interactive access or interactive session on that machine. So you just run remote procedure call-based management type of thing. I'm running remote service management, remote registry. I can browse remotely the files on that system, browsing a file share. This will never have my credentials on that machine I'm not trusting. I'm still running my help desk laptop or the domain admin. I'm not leaving that. I'm able to access over the network. My credentials are not there. I have the access rights. I'm not leaving anything on that machine. That's another very, very effective way of dealing with this problem.
Yeah, talking about deployment, by the way, in credentials, is kind of interesting. I have this experience from a penetration test we did once at a customer site. It was kind of hard to get into the first step into the infrastructure. But we had network access on the internal network, but we couldn't really get a good foothold. So what we did is we put a computer on the network and we pressed F12. Then a domain-joined computer suddenly got deployed. And that had the local admin account with the same password as every server and every computer in that environment.
Yeah.
So all you needed to do in order to hack the entire place was press F12. So maybe you should look into that yourselves. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
So that's what Mark has just told you, is simply password dependencies, that we have multiple different accounts. These are, in this case, the local admin accounts on many computers that happen to share the same password. So if I get hold of one of that, I can access any other computer over the network.
Yeah. And that was an important topic, so we spent some extra time on it. Let's move forward. What else should we talk about, Hussein? What do you think? How can we secure Windows?
Yeah, we can start looking at how we secure access to data, or at least sensitive.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So would you like me to show it first and speak about it?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about it, but do a demo.
So if you please switch to 5.
What number are you?
5, please.
You're 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. I'm running on client computer number 2, CLI 2. This is a file share I'm browsing on SRV2. So let's just go ahead and create a new text file. This is TechEd 2014. POP3 password. Wi-Fi. You know, the session yesterday. And keep going and then saving that document, okay? This is my document. I've created it. I can open it. I can change things in it and so on. Now, if we go back to the server side, this is our file server. This is the file server resource manager console. If I just right-click on classification rules and tell the system, hey, please run the classification rules that has been defined on this system, and then go back to my client and look at the results. Now, this is my document. I could open it. I created it. I added the text, whatever the content was. I don't have access to it anymore.
Did you know this feature? Did you know about it? How many of you guys are actively using it? Hands up. How many guys think it would be a good idea to use it? Hands up. A few. Okay, let's put it this way. Another thing we always do when we do penetration testing, and I say that because it's the same thing. This is what the hackers would do. But I'm not a hacker, I'm a pen tester, so this is how I see it. When we get network access, as soon as we can obtain one user account in the domain, the credentials of any regular user, we're going to try to mount every share on every file server. When we find one, for example, that, you know, the common big one that all the junk is stored in, the one that you had for years, you know which one I'm referring to, right? Yeah. We use tools cooler than fine string. And we go through each and every readable file in that entire server in that share, and we're looking for passwords. We find them in config files. We find them in scripts. We find them in backups of old computers that are like virtual machines stored or whatever. We extract them. We look through them as well. We find passwords. So using this simple technology that was used for being compliant with different standards, we can actually use it to protect you from getting hacked instead. It's meant for data protection, and it's still viable for data protection. But if you look at it from my perspective, being in enterprise security, trying to prevent people from getting hacked, I can look through all those big files, and I can decide whether or not that is a file containing passwords, if I can do the regular expressions right and set it up right so I find the right things. And then I can assign access rights.
Yeah.
So the only the right guy can connect to it. And I think that's really valuable because, you know, you don't want to go into those shares and try to, you know, look through every file and do everything yourself manually. So there's a tool out there.
So we're doing this in two steps. The first step, just as Marcus mentioned, we're classifying the file. So this is how we do it. This is the classification parameters. I'm looking simply for the string, the word, password. I'm not using any regular expressions, although you could do that. I'm just keeping it as simple as possible. Now, once the word password has been found, that string has been found, the confidentiality resource property is going to be set to high. It's going to flag that resource as highly confidential. And this is what this rule is doing. Now, I had to run this tool manually just to show you the effect. Normally, put this on a schedule. So this will be running automatically in the background from time to other and going through, digging through all the files and setting those attributes on the files. So this is the first piece. Now, the second piece is if we look at the security permissions, so the ACLs or access rights on this folder, I go to the advanced view. As you can see here, I'm actually saying, hey, users, let's see, system administrators and so on. We go to the advanced. I do have a redundant, special execute, and just special. It's not there. It relies actually in the central policy. So I'm applying a central policy called CAP01. And that central policy includes one specific rule in this case. The rule says, okay, the rule applies to a resource where the confidentiality resource property is set to high. Once that is met, that condition, no matter what file it is, it should be residing as on the subfolder to this folder I'm looking at. It's going to set the permissions explicitly to this list appearing below. So if it finds a resource flagged as highly confidential, it's going to override the local access rights and set them so only the admins and the system account has access to it. Now, how do we define these central policies? Let's go back to our Active Directory again. This is another feature that was introduced in Windows Server 2012. Let's see here. This is Active Directory Admin Center. It's the dynamic access control. So we're digging through that. I do have a central access rules and policies. This is my CAP01, CAP01. And there is an access rule called contains password. This is how I define it. So it says this is only targeting resources with confidentiality equal high, and it's setting the current permissions to this list. No matter what the current permissions on the file are, they will be changed. They will be forced to change. This is the effective current permission will be that way. So how do we define these different resource properties? Well, these are defined in Active Directory as well. As you can see, I have a definition of a couple of resource properties. One of them is the confidentiality. This one has been enabled for this demo. So once I enable that, I can deploy that on all my file server resources, and then I can start playing with it, start configuring it, and giving myself this flexibility I just showed you.
Yeah, I think this is one of the biggest problems with the Microsoft product today. It's hard to know what features are in there. There are so many features, and they can be used in so many different ways. So I think that's the grand idea of this session, even though it's not so sexy, is to take all these small features and visualize them so that you can see that they're there and explain how we can use them for our purposes. So I think this may be the most valuable thing when it comes to security, the understanding that it's already built in. You don't have to buy a lot of expensive third-party products to make this happen. You can do it with internal tools. Same thing with authentication mechanism assurance. You don't have to buy that cool third-party authentication thing for lots and lots of dollars. It's built in. All you need to do is see it and do some more research when you get back home. Download the white papers and the step-by-step guides. You can start playing with it. So let's keep going.
So this is about how we protect our file resources or information stored on files on our file servers. Now, any of you guys are dealing with being your own device, the BYOD situation? Okay.
So most of you guys do not have like mobile phones that accesses files or anything? Email? No? You don't do that? I'm just curious.
Let me just show you a very simple demo. Let's see if we go to this guy over here. Just gonna check. Am I? Oops. Good. This guy is a local user just running on this machine. Let me just try to access an internal application on this network. It's actually residing on SRV2. Now, things are happening if you're observing what's happening with the URL or the address line. You see, I typed in SRV02. It's now switching to adfs.secdemo.com. And soon it will be switching back to the server again. So what's happening here, the web application on that SRV02 or SRV2 is actually using federation as an authentication method. So I do have a federation enable a web application. It wants to have a ticket from my federation service. That's Active Directory Federation Services, ADFS. I do have on the other side. So once I tried to access the application, it went to the ADFS server, acquired the ticket, and went back again to this address. And now it got the ticket, so I was let in into this application. Let me just do this slightly different. Just want to run Internet Explorer as a different user. Now this time I'm running with not a local account. As you could see, I didn't need to enter any credentials for the local account. So some magic is happening in the background. So I'll go to the srv2secdemo.com, and pretty soon I should be redirected now to the Active Directory Federation Services that most probably would be sending a logon prompt to me.
So what's the point?
Yeah, why is it running kind of in the background automatically for one user but it's not doing for the other one? Let's check. I'm looking at the first user's certificates. This is the local admin user, only admin. This user has got a very special certificate. As you can see here, it's issued by MS Organization Access, client authentication purposes. If we look at this, as soon as it shows us the certificate, you see the issued to is not a name. It's a GUID type of thing. If we go back to the logon information, as you can see here, it says there is an identifier, there's a claim in the ticket, and an identifier, and that identifier should match the information in the certificate. It's ending with 12280E76. 122.8.E.7.6. So because I do have that certificate, I'm actually performing a single sign-on. This client with that certificate is able to log on to the ADFS service and getting its authentication ticket and handing it over to the web server, and there we are. This user is not part of Active Directory. It's, despite that, performing a single sign-on on the system. So where does that reside? What is the feature? What are we speaking about? We're speaking about device registration services. That's a feature was introduced with the latest version of ADFS. Let's say I go down to network. I go to workplace, and I see I'm actually workplace joining this machine or this specific session I do have here is so-called workplace joined. Now, this is a per user. Normally, when we deal with mobile devices, then this is a regular Windows 8.1 Enterprise Edition. When we deal with Android, iOS, or Windows RTs, or Windows Phone, the device is the user, kind of. We do have a single user experience. So we do join. We are joining the user session in a device. In this multi-user environment, this specific admin user is joined. This specific admin user has single sign-on to the internal resources. And I'm granting this specific user access to these resources at any time. The other guy, I just logged in with the regular domain. It's not joined. It doesn't have that single sign-on. It's required to enter the username and the password, the way we saw it.
So what do you think of the future? Do you think we're going to have domains the same way we have today? I don't think so either. We're going to have public resources or resources hosted in cloud services. And then we're going to somehow going to be able to choose which devices we're going to trust for our organization and somehow come up with some strong identification of the user. So this technology, even though you may or may not be using it today, if you want to stay in this business, this is what you should start looking into. I think this is the future. Federation services tying identity to devices. Because it's not going to be domain-joined computers. I don't know when it's going to end, but I think it's going to end.
Yeah, we're basically whitelisting a specific combination of this user on this device. Let's go. We do single sign-on, so we let that user and device combination access internal resources. This can be used with the web application proxy, which is now part of the remote access role. So if you have that configured, any workplace-joined devices or registered devices, as we call them, will have the same amount of access over the internet using the web application proxy component. Now, if we look behind the scenes, there is a registered device container in our Active Directory, and it contains an object. You see the name of the object is the same, 12-28E-76. You remember that? Now, there is a specific mapping within that object that says, hey, there is a security, alternate security identity, which is my certificate. That's this X509 certificate with this specific thumbprint. And it's mapping that to a SID value in Active Directory. So this is the device ID, and then I do have a registered owner of the device and registered users. These are SIDs in my Active Directory. This is the user SID presented on that object. So at the time of logon, ADFS will go look up these objects, figure out what certificate it is, what object I should look into, and what SID value that leads me to the user object. So it's getting back that information, putting it in the token or the ticket it's generating and pushing it back to the web service. Nobody needs to know anything about the user password. That's the most brilliant thing in here as well.
Yeah.
I can issue this to any device. I can distinguish between different devices. This is not just a regular user certificate. You cannot use it the regular way we use our user certificates. This is a very specific connection between the device registration and the user access. I can revoke any device at any time by modifying these objects.
Yes. So we're trying to solve different problems here. One problem is to bring your own device. Another problem is obviously the password dependencies. We can do physical security. We should talk a little bit about that, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, again, even though we don't have that many super new features, it's still very valid that people can obtain credentials, obtain a lot of data when they get access to a physical computer. So what do we have for that?
Speaking something about BitLocker, physical access?
Yeah, I think BitLocker, I mean, most people know that BitLocker is a very strong protection mechanism, but there are some small features that I think are worth mentioning. Also some other new security features like the secure boot and trusted boot and stuff. So
The whole deal about BitLocker, the way we look at it, the physical access, if you have a shutdown machine, I mean, machine not running, what happened if you press the power button? Well, of course, it will start going, loading the operating system and so on. So now the question, the most interesting here, am I going to have access to this device in such a state the operating system is up and running? Is that possible? Now, the second question, how about the hard drive? Is that encrypted, or is the data in the clear on that hard drive? Can I just take away that hard drive, set it somewhere else, and start looking at the information in it?
Yeah.
So if the hard drive is encrypted, now the first question will still be the one I'm looking at. Is it the fact that once I press the power button, the device is actually up in the running state within seconds or minutes? Then we can use some of the methods we've shown earlier. We've shown that at another TechEd last year, that we can easily do direct memory access to any device that is in a running state, harvesting credentials or other interesting information. So what we would like to recommend to you guys is start looking into, it shouldn't be possible to start a device that is basically shut off. If you put your device in sleep mode, it's not shut down. It's still there. It's awake. You can wake it up, and it's online. You can do direct memory access. You need to put it in hibernation mode or shut it down.
Yeah, this is actually the tool. This is something we showed last year. The demo is not so fancy, but it's kind of interesting. This is the main master key to every computer. Now you're looking, huh? You want it? I can't give it away, but this is just an express card. You put it in there. It will register itself as a RAM controller, and it will interact with the RAM of the computer. We just patch the logon function, so whenever you log on, you don't have to enter a password. And that's it. And this is a forensics tool. So I just want to show you that these tools are out there, and this is the reason you want to have BitLocker. I actually have people in my office where we do pen testing and stuff. We still do a lot of reporting on them. We're not domain joining those computers. But it's kind of funny. We don't even have a password on the local user. We actually use a blank password because you can't access the computer from the network with a blank password. We BitLocker and we have a PIN code. That's the password to that computer. Because it's kind of inconvenient to type the password twice. So we don't use the BitLocker password. We just use the user password. But food for thought. This is stronger. I mean, there are other implications when you, of course, are domain joined. You need to access resources and stuff. But still, BitLocker is what saves us. If we have a PIN code on it, it's really strong.
And you have all the possibilities to configure recovery policies in Active Directory, of course. So you have the recovery keys been backed up to your Active Directory as a database. Let's just have a very quick look at that.
Why don't everybody use BitLocker? Yeah. Obviously, like Hassan is saying, it's kind of hard when you forget your PIN code, right? The recovery stuff. There are some really interesting settings in Windows. One is how many of you guys heard about Network Unlock? That's not too many either. So I think those are the things that if we just show them and it becomes apparent to you that they exist, that may change your decision whether or not to use BitLocker. So please explain that as well.
Yes. Simon. So this is, at a minimum, I would definitely recommend you to configure the recovery options. This is no matter if you're going to support BitLocker centrally or not. If a user chooses to enable BitLocker on his or her device, you will most probably end up with a situation, oh, I need to recover. Do you have my keys? and I do have corporate information on that computer, you're interested into that, you don't want to lose it. So just enabling it says, hey, omit the recovery options, don't ask the user about recovery options. Please save the BitLocker recovery information to Active Directory services, and do not enable BitLocker unless we can do this operation. So please don't enable BitLocker until we can have a safe copy of the recovery key. So this is a very simple setup, a very simple config we can do. I'm just showing you this is on removable data drives. You can do it on operating system drives, and you can do it on other fixed drives, that other hard drives on your system. So if, once you've done that, you have all the keys backed up in Active Directory. Any user with any problem, you can just go and look the key up using the key identity and then give that recovery key to your users. Okay, simple as that.
Yeah.
The network unlock feature that Marcus mentioned, it's actually part of the Windows deployment services. And it's basically you're trusting the WDS service to provide the TPM chip PIN code to the device at the startup. So once the device is starting up, it's configured for network unlock. If there is an unlock server available on the LAN, it's going to do a specific boot P request. If it gets a hold of the unlock service, it will get the TPM PIN provided in a secure channel back to it so it can push it into the TPM chip.
Yeah, that basically means if somebody steals your computer because you lost it in a taxi, they can't use it. They have to get into your internal network in order to do it. On the other hand, when you're inside the network, you don't have to enter the PIN code.
Mm-hmm.
So that's convenient.
And you can do wake and LANs and all that kind of activities. The clients will, as far as they are on the LAN, they will respond, and you can deal with patching and other activities as well. Cool. Next.
Yeah, I think we should talk about networking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the last piece of this discussion. If we can somehow find a way to stop attackers from jumping from one computer to another, that would change a lot. Just think about it. Is there any reason for a client to be able to connect to another client on your network, really? There is not. Is there a reason for a normal client to ever be physically able to connect to a backend server? Not really, no. Do you think they can in your environment today? They can. Not in yours. Where? So again, back to the real world, back to what we see every day, like we've shown in the other sessions. If you do a brute force attack on all the exposed SQL servers on the entire network when you have internal access, you will find some of them servers with weak username and password. But again, there's no reason that they're accessible from the client network. That's the exit, my friend.
So let's just give a quick demo about this. Can we implement something that can help us distinguish between the right and the wrong user, so to say, already at the network layer? We're not speaking about the application. We're not speaking about your knocking the door and RDP protocol answering, is it the right or wrong user you're allowed or not allowed to log on to that RDP session. These are two remote desktop connections, clients. They're running on the same server. So with this guy, I can apparently not really. Yes, I can connect. I'm receiving a logon prompt. So there is a connection between this client and the SRV4 server. On the other hand, on this other guy, if I try to connect, I will end up with a timeout. They're running on the same machine. It's the same IP address. Apparently, we do the same desktop session and so on. But still, I can connect with this guy over here, but not with this guy over there.
And again, this has nothing to do with terminal services. This is just a simple way of demonstrating it, okay?
So what's the deal? Let's see. If I'm running Process Explorer, of course. I do have two MSTSC EXE processes running here. So if I pick the first one of them, it says SRV5 /administrator. This is apparently a local admin account in SRV5. This is SRV5 we're running. And the second process is running with the SEC demo /administrator account. So the local admin account, when we proceed to connect RDP to the other server in this demo, it was refused the network connection as such. We didn't even get a prompt to say, hey, you're not allowed to connect, you're not authoritative to access the system. The network layer is preventing us from going over there. Whilst when we were running the admin account, that was, please go ahead. You can touch base with that system and you can try your credentials, and that system will tell you whether you are authorized or not at the application level. So the magic behind this is simply IPsec and IPsec policies. This is what Microsoft introduced in Windows back in the days and started calling it domain isolation and service isolation. So let's just look at the SRV4. Let's go back to there and look at the firewall. And as you can see here, this is the inbound rule on the local firewall in SRV4. There is a slightly different in the icon represented here. You see the lock here instead of just the green mark? It says allow this connection if it is secure. So this simply means we need to know about the identity of the user running on the other end, the compound identity of the user and the machine trying to establish this access on the other side. And unless it is any of this, you're not allowed to connect. That's on the network level. So the firewall is preventing that access way before it can reach the RDP session or the RDP protocol.
So if we could somehow define front-end servers, back-end servers, admin clients, regular clients, and if we could make network silos so that the right kind of computers would have, or users, because you can set this on computer and or user, then you could actually create a network where you only have different zones. Regular clients can access front-end servers. Front-end servers can access back-end servers. Admin clients has an exception. They can access back-end servers. If you want to be more granular, you can be very granular. Mm-hmm. Why is nobody using this? And this is a rhetorical question. Why are we not using this? Microsoft invested a lot of time in building it. It's put into the local firewall on every server, so we have it already, right? I mean, I don't even need a raise of hands. Everybody accepts the fact that this is a very strong feature. You trust the Windows firewall. It's a solid, rock-solid firewall. I don't know anybody who can remotely open a port without compromising the computer first. I don't think anybody knows exactly how to circumvent the IPsec encryption that's going to go on the network if you have all the settings right. So why aren't we using it? Well, there's a good answer to that. It's damn hard to manage. In the real world, we've been trying for years. It doesn't work. You have some exceptions, and you have like 500 GPOs with all the different firewall settings for all the different roles in computers, and you change an exception. You have to go into each and every rule to change it. I wouldn't say crazy, because you can't say that about a Microsoft solution in a Microsoft conference, of course. But it's not very manageable, okay? So I'm just going to give you an example. I just want to show you a tool, because there are tools out there that can do this. So do we have, for this one, is it even connected to?
It's number two.
Number two, good. So I want to show you that these things exist. And I'm not saying you have to buy the tool, but you should know that there are solutions that you can use in order to make the firewall manageable. And this is one of those tools. So this is a plugin for server management system center. So this is more targeted to enterprise customers. But you have firewall rules and rule sets. You have IP scopes for exceptions and stuff. And then you have zones. So you can define a zone, like all zone items. So you can have like a zone called front-end web servers, a zone called back-end web servers. You can put computers in there, you can tie it to rule sets. And then you can do connection rules between the different zones. So you only have to manage zones. You don't have to manage individual computers or group policies. And there are places for IP scopes for exceptions and stuff. So I just wanted to show you that this stuff exists. So you can actually start using that. You don't necessarily have to buy these static solutions that will enforce you to trust static IP addressing. Because this is the beauty about the concept with IPsec rules and the firewall. You're controlling it through membership of groups. And think about the future again. Think about the cloud. If you use the firewall and the IPsec rules in the firewall, you can take a computer and you can move it to the cloud or to a new ISP or wherever. It will still be a member of the same group, so the same firewall rules will apply. The backend server will still just listen to front-end servers wherever you put it. So it's actually way more manageable and easier than having a regular firewall that needs to be configured every time you move a server to some other place, which would make you end up with hundreds of rules that you don't even know what they mean in the end.
So just to verify the thing Marcus said, as you can see here, the scope of this rule is says any IP, anywhere. We don't care, local IP, remote IP, anything. So the only thing we care about is this user is logged in on any of our domain members. Now, I could actually strengthen that even more and say, hey, I would like to see that user logged in on this specific computer as well. So I can tie them together and define the silo even better. So unless you're running this user or these users from these computers, you're not allowed to connect to these type of services. Now, the connection security rule, the IPsec rule behind, is pretty simple. In this case, it's not even required. It's just a requesting IPsec. It's not an absolute requirement that you go ahead with IPsec. So if you can perform an IPsec authentication, we can carry that information with us and push it into the inbound rule and feed it with that information. If you don't, well, that rule is not available. That's why we were getting the timeout. A local account will never manage it to perform the authentication because, in this case, the authentication is based on the Kerberos V5. That's a domain user on a domain computer. So these two computers were offering each other's possibility to authenticate any packages going over the network and then grabbing those identities, pushing them into the inbound rules. Now, this is exactly the same thing we do whenever we run direct access. So how many of you guys here running direct access? Just a quick, okay. For those of you who are not running direct access yet, I can just show you what direct access is really about. Well, it's giving us possibility to access our internal resources from wherever. The look and feel for the user, there is no difference between internal connection, external network connection, and so on. So it's all about a couple of IPsec policies that works between the direct access server and our clients, and making it possible for the clients to traverse that direct access server and reach our internal resources at any time. So there are no specific inbound rules. It's all about these two IPsec tunnels being established between my client and my direct access server and reaching into internal resources. So this is just an extension of the service and domain isolation Microsoft provided us already in Windows 2000.
Yeah. So I think it's time to wrap this up. I know it's been a long day, and it's time to do something more fun. So, because this is not fun, this is important. That's a different thing. So, some things before we end this session, so don't get up yet and walk away. I would love if you start to play around with this technology. It's very easy to go to the Microsoft sites and find these step-by-steps. You don't have to pay anything, it's all there. And it's very easy today to just set up some demo machine and just try in Hyper-V or whatever. You would never use VMware, of course. So, I used to do that, I took heat for that too. So. At least in these sessions. So that's one thing. Another thing that we want to promote a little bit is Hassan and I, we're doing some training in the US. So if you're interested in getting hands-on, the stuff that we're talking about, while you don't have time to set up your own environments and stuff, we do these simple 3-day or 5-day courses. Very rarely, But if you're interested, you can probably look us up on the internet or something. So that is another thing. I also have this online challenge thing. If you're interested in the security problems, you can go to challenge.truesec.com and you can log on. It doesn't cost anything. If you want to do some hacking and see, understand the problem and see if you can get your mindset as a hacker to understand this better. So those are some small things that you can do if you want to pursue the security. I mean, some of you guys work in security, but some are just generally interested. But again, I think the biggest take home from this is to think about the fact that you can open the box of Windows and look inside. There are a lot of different features. Some of them can be used for very good things when it comes to security environment, even though they weren't meant for it. Like the authentication mechanism assurance, like the indexing of files that you can connect. So, to me, that's it.
Let's see, I just have another quick word. I was approached yesterday by many guys here at TechEd about this advisory. There's an update that was released yesterday. It's addressing passing the hash, passing the token in such way that it's making some of the protection mechanism that was released to Windows 8, Windows 8.1, available for Windows 7 as well. So this is about making those protection mechanisms, like the protected users and so forth, available for Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 R2. I'm really keen on mentioning this because we previously said in our sessions that this is, as of today, only available on Windows 8 and above. So from this patch on, from this advisory from yesterday on, this is available on Windows 7. So the protected users and the LSA enhancements are available on Windows 7, Windows 2000 R2. So this is supposed to be an automatic patch. It's a security patch. It should apply to all your machines without the need to download it separately, so to say.
So I don't think you have any idea how hard it is for someone to stand on stage and operate like 7, 8 different machines doing the live demos and be absolutely conscious where you are all the time and make it all happen. So I think Assign needs a little appreciation for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very easy when you have like a week to implement something. It's a different thing. He built all this yesterday or something. That's very easy.
Well, so, actually, not to brag, but let's see. I built this after lunch.
Yeah, it's true. It's called Hydration Script, an experience. Anyhow, we would love if you fill out the evals. I mean, we come here once a year. We were psyched to be here. We really enjoy what we're doing. And obviously, hacking is sexier, but this is more important. And I think this is the first time we filled the house on a security session that was just about implementing security, which means that there's a change in the world. People are getting interested in actually doing something. They don't just want to be amused. So I think that's a very good sign. Mm-hmm. For me, the biggest reward ever would be if you came back next year and you told me, well, we did one of those things. Or more than that. That would be an amazing feeling, having thousands of people and a large number of them coming back and say, something happened because of this mm-hmm. session. I decided to make a change.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. So please fill out the evals. If you liked the session, tell us what you liked about it. If there were some things that we could improve for the future, we'd love to hear that too, because we really want to give you, we're here for you, so we want to give you what we can and what we know. So again, see you in the booth, 1947 if you want to win our laptops. Otherwise, we're going to be down in that booth if you have questions or whatever. And if not that, we're going to be on the floor wherever. Grab us if you have questions, anything you want. We're here for you. We're not like the fancy, cool guys sitting in the speaker lounge all day long. We're down on the floor with you guys. So thank you.
Thank you, guys.